Are you looking to optimize your performance, grow your mind, and change your system? Well, you've come to the right place. I'm Brad Baker.
And I'm Tom Broback.
And this is the Bold Base Performance Podcast.
Hello, friends. Welcome to the show. I'm Tom Broback, and my guest today is Jenny Rierk. Jenny has one of the most unique and helpful careers. She founded Fit to Speak to help fitness, health, and sport professionals to improve their communication and presentation skills. As someone who runs his own podcast and social media, I found her information incredibly valuable, and I know you will too. Follow her on Twitter at Jenny_Rierk, and make sure to check out her website, fit-to-speak.com. Let's continue to grow the mind and change the system. How did you get interested in fitness and health and sports? Where did that come from? Where did that passion come from? And we'll go from there.
Yes, sports. Sports has always been a part of my life. I played volleyball mostly. I was a multi-sport athlete when I was younger. And then as soon as I got into high school, I started playing club volleyball and I was playing school volleyball as well. And I was a late bloomer. So all of the girls that I played club with and in high school, they all got Division I scholarships. And I changed positions from an outside hitter to a setter my junior year of high school. And my club coach at the time was also the coach at Northern Illinois University. And he was a setter's coach. He played at Ohio State himself. So he recruited me. I ended up going and playing as the starting setter at Northern Illinois University on a full scholarship. And at the time, my parents were going through a really rough divorce. I was homesick and I was not at all prepared for the demand of playing a Division I sport. I started doing poorly in school. I didn't enjoy my teammates. There was no support from the coaching staff emotionally. And unfortunately, at the time, I didn't have the maturity to speak up and say something to them, which I think it was kind of the seed of all this communication stuff. Mm-hmm. I ended up giving up my scholarship. I went and played at a D3 school instead in Dubuque, Iowa. It was the best athletic decision I've ever made in my life. I loved my team. It was all about the enjoyment of the sport. And then my career took me into marketing and advertising. And once I left college sports, I felt this huge hole of, what am I doing? I don't know what I'm doing. Yep. Sports has always been my life. Mm-hmm. I enjoyed my job, but I didn't feel like I had any sort of meaning at all. I was just kind of punching a clock. So I got involved with CrossFit and I started competing in Olympic weightlifting. So I was doing that outside of my full-time corporate job. And then I began to teach CrossFit and I found a really great gym. I started to teach an Olympic weightlifting team. And then you fast forward a few years, I moved to San Francisco and I was still doing that. I was a director of a project management team at a large advertising agency. I was playing a game of competitive adult rec league volleyball and I tore my ACL and both meniscus.
Oh no.
Yeah. And this was funny enough. I did this about 2 weeks after I went on my first date with Brendan, my husband. And I had never heard of CFSC. I mean, I was involved in fitness and whatnot, but
right.
He helped me rehab and he was a big part of that. And I took CFSC. I became enthralled with it. I read about it. Brendan and I talked about it nonstop. And at that point, I realized there's a lot here that I can help teach people. And I had already been coaching for quite some time. Fast forward another year, I was able to then start teaching for CFSC. So from a fitness side, I'm now an educator and I go mostly on the West Coast here, teach some of the certified functional strength coach courses. Now, Brendan and I also now have since opened up a a small studio gym in our home. We renovated our garage to be a personal training studio that's called Train Smarter and Harder. So I'm a gym owner. I educate for CFSC. And then, as you know, I also have a corporate job, and that is I teach people how to public speak, communicate, be better at writing, business related communications, and that sort of thing.
There's a lot to unpack there. Let's go back to your, whatever you're in college, freshman, sophomore, junior year, and not talking about the divorce, because I don't think there's anything in life that can prepare a kid or a child or even a young adult for a divorce of their parents. But going to that time where you really struggled with transitioning with sports and with schools and with the motivation, what resources did you wish you would have had at that point, either to make a better informed decision or to help with the decisions that you did make?
I just remember getting to school about a month before school started, because volleyball is a fall season, and we got put up in the dorm rooms. They did not allow us to room with other girls on our team. That was just a rule that they had. So I was rooming with just some random student that was not an athlete. That was the first problem. Mm-hmm. She was out partying until 3 a.m. I was getting up at 5 a.m. to walk half of a mile to the gym to go practice. That was bad. That was hard, not to mention getting up, and you're in DeKalb, Illinois, which is in the middle of cornfields. My coach, I had known him. He was my club coach, and I absolutely loved him in club. When I got to my collegiate season with him, he was a much different coach in a collegiate setting, much tougher. He was verbally very aggressive. And at the time, that was super unhealthy for me. If I could go back and do it again, I would crush it, and I would absolutely love it if I was who I am right now, but right. I was not who I am right now. Mm-hmm. And no one on that coaching staff did any sort of, they took no action to get to know me and understand where I was at emotionally. And again, like I said, I didn't have the maturity to ask for help.
Right.
And so I didn't seek out resources. Nobody asked me about anything. And I kind of just fell into this very isolated place. And I felt alone. I began to feel more homesick. We were missing a lot of school. I wasn't doing well in school. And basically what they tell you is you essentially just have to get average grades. They don't really care that much. Or at least they didn't when I was there. Mm-hmm. So that, to me, I think solidified that from a coaching standpoint, caring is the most crucial element in getting trust, in getting people to do their best for you. Because I'm tooting my own horn a little bit, but I was a great athlete. I ended up doing very well in D3, and that was because of the coaching difference. I felt supported emotionally, and especially I think for female athletes, that emotional support is even more important to come first before you're asking them to do all of these sport related things.
Do you feel that emotional support has to come from the coaching staff, or can you get that from another resource or another opportunity that is not related to the team that you're on?
Of course, I think you can get it from other places. I do think, though, looking back at how much time when you're playing a Division I sport you spend with your team and your coaches, you see them multiple hours a day. You're traveling with them, you're doing all those things. So for me to have a feeling every day of dreading getting up and going to practice that's not good. And I remember just thinking, I used to love this sport. I don't want to be here. I would cry before having to go to practice, and that's not healthy at all. And unfortunately, it wasn't made aware enough to me how I could get help for myself. I didn't have the maturity to seek the help. And whether someone noticed or not, they never brought it to my attention, and nobody asked, not even my teammates. So, and I know that's not like that in all places, but I do know there are a lot of other Division I athletes that I've spoken to that have had the same experience. And fortunately, if you have a supportive, communicative family that you can rely on when that's happening, that helps. But at the time for me, it was like the perfect storm. My family was a mess. Mm-hmm. My boyfriend at the time was going to a different school. I wasn't getting along with my teammates or my coach. And so it just, the environment was not there for me to succeed there.
Absolutely. And that's really hard when you're, you know, 17, 18, 19 years old. And like you said, you took some ownership in saying you didn't have the maturity to reach out. And I think that's the part that gets lost when we reflect on previous struggles or previous issues, is we forget, you know, that we were immature, or how emotional we were, or how undisciplined we were. And we've learned from that and we've grown from that. But I do think it means a lot when you take some ownership of that situation and not blame it on everybody else, because life's not like that. There's at some point a little bit of you has to be responsible for what happened or didn't happen. And that's how we learn. And that's how we grow.
Exactly. Exactly. And I can't go back and change what had happened then. I do know a few years after I left, or maybe after I graduated college, I emailed that coach from my Division I college. And I didn't apologize, but I essentially explained what had happened to me at that time and my perception of the situation looking back on it. That was cathartic for me. And I did feel that I owed him more of an explanation than I was able to give at the time. But I learned a lesson. Taking all those experiences into my job, it forced me to realize that if I wanted something and I needed help or I needed support, people don't usually outwardly ask you. They don't offer it mm-hmm. to you. You have to find strategies and grow the confidence to be able to make that request for yourself. And once you can do that, it's unbelievable. It completely accelerates your emotional growth, and it solidifies you as a person, and if you prove to yourself that you're worth asking for help, because people don't want to save you. People are always worried about themselves. And that's true. I mean, that's not for bad reasons, but they're not thinking about you all day long. They're thinking about themselves.
It's important. People are always thinking, as I'm interrupting you here, people are always thinking about themselves. How does the situation affect me? And what can I gain from this? Or what is this going to cost me? I agree with you on that. Can you give a specific example of when a strength coach, a personal trainer, there's a situation where they need to ask for help and they continually avoid doing it, and they would benefit greatly if they simply were direct and asked for help in that situation?
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a short story about somebody that I was working with, and I don't know if it will answer your question, so you'll have to tell me that when I'm done. I was working with a woman who is a personal trainer, and she also does nutrition coaching. She works at a bigger gym, and I believe that the majority of the staff that she was working with was males. Now, men and women are different. Yes, I believe everybody should be treated fairly, but men and women communicate differently. And for a female, for her in that situation, she was struggling to, she felt like nobody was interested in her opinion. And so there would be a lot of group conversations going on amongst the staff without her participation, or at least them not soliciting her opinion. And that was hurtful to her. But on the same side of that, she also realized that she wasn't interjecting at all. But she felt like there was a wall there that was put up in front of her, and that she didn't necessarily have the tools to be able to break down and get through. So her and I work specifically on assertive communication, because the skills to be able to say, I have an opinion or I have feelings and I at least deserve to be heard. Not necessarily people don't need to say yes to every request I make, but having the confidence to step in and say, this is what I think. Here are the reasons why I think that, take it or leave it. And the reason it's not, I think everybody could get better about being an assertive communicator. I none of us, or at least no one that I know, has ever formally been taught how that sounds.
Right.
So what her and I worked with was, here's verbatim, essentially, how you can frame what you want to say or interject so that it doesn't come off like you're complaining. It doesn't come off like you are being a bully or aggressive, or that you're being passive aggressive. So I think for anybody that's listening that is in the fitness space, that you feel you hesitate before you interject something in the field, whether that be just on social media, putting yourself out there, or participating in a conversation with people that you might believe are more of an authority figure in the field than you are. Mostly, I think that fear and then anxiety, or that struggle to step forward and say something, comes from you just not having the tools or understanding about how to say it. And that's what got me started in what I'm doing now, is communication. Everybody knows communication is important. I don't have to preach that to people, but communication is this big, confusing web of all these elements that nobody quite understands. And now that I've been doing it solely for the last 4 years, that web is very simple. And my hope is that I can simplify all of these different components of communication enough that people can actually take action on them.
That helps me out a lot, because the times that I get the most frustrated or agitated is when I get upset that someone didn't read my mind, and I vent to a third party, and they say, well, did you tell them how you felt, or did you tell them what you thought? And I'm like, no, they should know how I feel, or know what I want, or know what I expect. And there's that disconnect. And then when I try to address it, it goes so much better. And mm-hmm. I don't know if it's a, do you think it's a fear of being, just bringing issues up, or is it a fear of interjecting, or is it something else rather than feared or afraid or consequences?
I think it's all of those things. Sure. I also think that when we're in a relationship with someone, and I don't mean that romantically, any right. sort of relationship, we have expectations of people, and we feel most cared for and acknowledged when people proactively do things for us or notice things about us without yep. us having to say so.
Yep.
And that if anybody on this is in some sort of romantic relationship, that is like the epitome of every single fight that happens in a romantic relationship, is you should have known.
Yeah.
It's like a lot of that comes from the labels that we put on people. You're my husband, you're my girlfriend, my boyfriend, whatever it might be. You're supposed to know this about me. You're the one who knows me best. But it's extremely special when somebody proactively notices something about you. But why not just step forward and ask so you can get what you need right now? And the best part is that your partner then feels really good about themselves, because they're actually able to take some sort of action because you've made a direct request. And they feel then like, okay, I've been successful. I was able to actually help my partner. Whereas if you just leave it all up to chance, even if they do end up helping you, it's probably not in the exact way you want it. So why not just tell them exactly what you want them to do? And if they don't want to do it, they'll tell you no. And my Brendan has a daughter. So my stepdaughter, her name is Rain. She's 6. This is something that I had a conversation with her about yesterday, is she wants to eat cupcakes or candy every single day.
Oh, that sounds like me. Perfect.
And Brendan too. So I say no, and I say yes. We create a balance in our household, and she has become afraid to ask because she doesn't want to hear no. And I've realized this. So yesterday we had a whole conversation, and I said, look, Rain, anytime you want something, you need to ask me. No questions about it. You just need to ask, because your entire life, you were going to want things. And if you don't ask, the answer is always going to be no.
Right.
But there's a 50% chance that I'm going to say yes. And the only time I'm going to say yes is if you ask me, because I'm not just going to offer you candy and cupcakes.
Right.
And she laughed, but I think she got it. And I think that's a lesson that not only kids need to learn, but us as adults need to remind ourselves of is that you don't get what you don't ask for. But on the same side of that, if people say no, you have to respect a boundary and either go find somebody else to ask or wait a little bit and ask again. But we can't, you can't just assume that somebody's going to say no because of your previous experience, because then you're never going to go anywhere.
Can we dive into that a little bit more? Because with the podcast, there are examples out there where I'm afraid to ask someone to be on the podcast because they might say no. But then I think to myself, they're not going to ask me to be on my podcast. You know, like you have to go out and reach to them. And if you never ask, the answer is always no. And if they say no, there's no consequences. I don't lose any money. I don't lose any time. I don't lose any sleep. They simply, and it's usually a conflict of schedule. They're busy and they can't make it work. Why are people so, and I don't know if it's fear again, or why are they afraid of getting a no when that no has virtually zero consequence in what happens in the rest of their day or life?
Right. Well, when we hear no from somebody, we instinctually take it as a personal rejection. But what's interesting is that in the scenario you just provided with asking somebody who you don't know personally and they're saying no to you, that in no way is personal because they don't even know who you are.
Right.
So they are not rejecting you in any personal way whatsoever. And to say that out loud, logically, it makes sense, but we are emotional before we are logical. And so when we anticipate somebody saying no, what we're really saying is I'm not ready to be personally rejected right now. And so I'm not going to ask. I think there are things from a communication standpoint that we can all do to make it more likely that they will say yes than no. And that is, anytime we're going to make a request of somebody, we have to appeal to that person's interests and not our own. And understanding or trying to put ourselves in their shoes and saying, what value have they brought to me that is enticing me to want to make this request of them? How can I articulate that to them? What value do I think will come of them giving me their time? And how can I articulate to them so that they see it as a quality investment of their time? So I think a little bit of forethought can increase the likelihood that we are responded to in the way that we want. But as you said, it's rejection. We don't want to be rejected. And we also know that in order to be successful, we need to be liked by people. I wrote an article a few months ago. It's on my blog website, but it's about likability.
Sure.
Unless you work, maybe you're in coding and you work in a dungeon by yourself all the time. We work with people. We collaborate. Right. Even if you are a solo practitioner, we collaborate with people all the time. Your clients have to like you. Your coworkers have to like you. People in your field have to like you in order to bring business opportunities your way. And so when people say no to us, even if that means that they simply couldn't do it because their schedule didn't work, we see that as them saying, I don't like you. Mm-hmm. But that's the stories we tell ourselves are our reality. And if you can't change the story, then your reality is always going to be, I'm not liked. And then you'll stop taking fewer chances and then you'll become stagnant and then you're not happy.
I've also noticed that the people who have, and this isn't anything new, but the people who have achieved the most in life are the ones who have failed the most or been rejected the most. And they've found ways to be resilient and overcome those obstacles. And that kind of reminded me of your story in college. Did you take everything that was happening personally, like it was an attack on you, whether it was the divorce or like the school not working out or the sport not working out? Did you take that all too personally? And did that have an effect on how you managed it?
Absolutely. I mean, every criticism I received from my coach, it was just like another thing of, oh, he doesn't like me. He doesn't like me. He doesn't like me. When in reality, looking back, he was coaching me. But I was listening to Randall Stutman, I believe it's called Admirable Leadership, or he has some company that coaches leaders and on the skills of admiration and being better leaders. Anyway, on the podcast that I listened to him on, he talked about this idea of balanced feedback. And that in any one scenario, if you are going to give someone critical feedback, you should always balance it with an equal amount of praise. And the praise you give somebody should be as vivid and intense as the criticism.
Okay.
Because when we criticize people, we're like armed with 10 examples of here, you did on Tuesday at this time, you did this wrong, and then you did this wrong in this way. But when we praise them, praise sounds like good job. It's so fluffy. And then our criticism is so detailed that there's this imbalance. And when you think about that over the course of a relationship, that's how relationships get out of balance, is that if your relationship is characterized by mostly negative or critical feedback, and there's not a whole lot of positive, every time you approach that person, they're immediately going to become defensive because their experience with you has been that it's always critical feedback. So that's it. That's just quality information for you, though. If you have somebody in your life who reacts to you immediately, very defensively, or they back away and they disengage from you right away, what you probably want to be aware of is that, okay, my relationship with this person is out of balance. They are assuming that what I'm going to say to them is going to be negative. I need to rebalance this relationship and fill up the bank account a little bit more before I keep taking withdrawals.
I like that analogy. When you say you want that even, is that over like the course of time, over the, you know, weeks and months, or is it every interaction you want to try to keep it pretty even?
Yeah, in a perfect world, it would be every interaction.
Right.
I mean, we're human beings. There are going to be moments when you're going to give them 5 critical pieces of feedback, but you've only got 1 piece of praise for them. That's going to happen. But
right.
As the next time something comes up, you have to consider, okay, last time was characterized by negative criticism. Do I have something? I need to find something that I can pull in here to balance it back up. Otherwise, they're not going to receive the criticism.
Right.
And when criticism isn't received, it's useless.
Mm-hmm.
And it's your job as the one delivering that to people to create an environment that allows them to feel safe enough to receive and act on the feedback.
And I would think the one who is giving the criticism always views it as they don't take it well, when they are instead not self-auditing. How am I approaching this person? Do I have some kind of bias towards them? Do I have some kind of reaction? Are they my punching bag because I don't have anyone else to vent to? And I think that lack of self-auditing, and I'm just as guilty of this as anyone else.
Me too.
Perfect. I'm glad we're human. But I think that can lead to, again, this lack in communication. It's this kind of catchphrase sometimes, this big word. But when you don't realize you're the one who's part of the problem, then you're going to have this negative lens towards that individual, no matter what happens.
Right. Well, and it's one of the most frequent questions I get from trainers, practitioners,
yeah,
since I've been doing this, is how do I communicate with difficult people? But that's it. It's
right.
What happened that got you to a place where you find this person to be difficult? Because in reality, they're not difficult. What you're realizing and just not able to articulate is that you've realized you do not have the skills to be successful with this person. And that is not their fault. That is you. And when the moment you can realize that, okay, this is simply information that I've identified an area that I'm not good at, or I don't have the skills to be successful in this scenario, that's just an opportunity for you to get better. But
absolutely,
instead, most of us choose to just complain and say, oh, you don't just, that person, nobody likes them, they're just a problem. And that's sad, because that really creates this vicious cycle for that person who's constantly demonized. And there are, of course, people who are difficult people who don't help themselves in any way, but most people are not. It's simply that the way they interact is is outside of the norm. And many people just don't have the tools in order to be able to interact with that person successfully.
The two people that I tend in my brain to label as difficult are people that are eerily as identical as I am in terms of personality and communication, because I know, you know, like the pros and the cons of being me. And then the people who communicate or have a personality that's so much different than mine. And I haven't found the way to interact with them or to motivate them or to challenge them or to give them criticism. But that's not necessarily a reflection on them, because they probably have the same thing with me. He's so much different than I am. Like we both have to find a way to meet each other halfway to have a positive relationship. Would you say coaches give you that feedback too?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, one thing that I think people aren't doing that's a really simple step is this difficult person that you're interacting with. That difficult person has all of the information you need in order to be successful with them. But none of us take the step to ask that person. And all that sounds like is, I'm having a hard time figuring out how to make this work. There's a lot of tension between us all of the time. What do the successful relationships in your life look like? How does the communication work? Can you tell me about what I can do to better communicate with you? That person knows themselves. Why not ask them to tell you what you need to do? And again, I'm not saying that you then have to do everything they tell you to, but that person is the source of information. They are the holy grail. Why not ask them to tell you how you can be more successful with them? And all that says is, or tell me about a time in your life that you were really successful so that I can try and create that same environment here.
What's the barrier preventing people from taking that initiative to learn about that person?
It's hard. It's a lot more work. And I think that when we judge people as difficult, we almost want to make them feel bad, because we think that making them feel bad will entice them to be less difficult.
Right.
It's like, let me shame you a little bit or make you think that I don't like you, because maybe if you think I don't like you, you'll change. But that's not true, really, because what that person is probably thinking is that you're just as difficult as you're thinking they're difficult.
Right. And then you double down on who you are, and then you become more difficult in their eyes, even though, you know, the more someone says, Tom, you know, quit drinking water during the podcast, I'm just going to start drinking more water, because it's like, oh, they don't like it, I'm going to do more of it. If they don't like the way I interact with them, I'm going to keep doing more of it, because I like me and I like the way I do it. And I want to even spite them sometimes. So I think
exactly.
It probably creates more of a divide when you lash out or you know, react to a negative circumstance like that, for sure.
Well, you also have to remember that people who are consistently labeled as difficult, think about how lackluster most of their interactions are then. It's probably safe to assume that they have very few interactions that are positive interactions if everybody's having the same impression. And it's an opportunity for you to be the one person that treats them differently. And it's like if you talk to teachers who work with students who have consistently had trouble in school that are difficult in their disciplinary issues. And then all of a sudden there's one teacher that miraculously like solves the problem child. That teacher didn't solve anything. All that teacher did was they allow themselves to be a servant to that person and allow that person to tell them, hey, this is how I need to be interacted with in order for you to disarm me and for this relationship to progress. So, I mean, and that is what defines a coach, right? It's a servant mindset. It's figuring out how you need to change in order to fit into this person's world to get them to achieve these long-term goals. So you need to be a little bit of a chameleon, and it takes confidence to be a chameleon, because you're playing the long game, and playing the long game is hard. playing the long game, there's not a guarantee in anything, and you have to self-sacrifice a lot, and you have to do things that you necessarily wouldn't do in other scenarios simply to achieve, you know, whatever's on the horizon. That was a little bit wordy, but am I making sense?
You're helping me out a lot, because I really struggle with a lot of some of this stuff. And that's one of the reasons I want to talk to you, because there's so much of your, even just the podcast, it's a great opportunity, because I get to talk to someone. I get to hear their story. I get to listen to them. I get to ask some engaging questions. It's all about that communicative piece. And so much of, you know, whether it's physical therapy, personal training, strength, whatever you want to call it, health and fitness, so much of it is relationship. And it doesn't really matter how many sets you're doing today. It doesn't matter what exercise you're doing. It doesn't even matter what time of day you're doing it at. Are you having a positive interaction with the person that you're working with, whether it's a client or a colleague or your boss? One thing that I've noticed that is challenging when working with clients is timing and getting clients to, or patients to come on time or to come early or to make their own appointments or not cancel, things like that. Have you had success working with coaches and helping them communicate with clients about different aspects of timing?
Yes. I'm going to try and put this into steps so that it's easy to follow. The first thing is that you need to communicate your expectations. And that's a step that most people miss, is that they just assume that your client knows that you want them to show up 10 minutes before the start time. Mm-hmm. And then the client comes up, let's say you're training them at 5 p.m. You're expecting them to show up at 4:45. The client walks in at 5 p.m. and you're upset now. You're thinking they don't care, they didn't show up early. When in fact, the client might have thought that, okay, she's going to be with her client until the top of an hour, so I don't want to come in early. I'll just wait until my start time. The first step is to communicate your expectations. If you have a group class and you're starting at the top of the hour, when you sign people up, our expectation is that you come at least 5 minutes early. If you show up at 5 p.m., you will miss at least 5 minutes of the warm-up, because we will get started at 5 p.m. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, it's only a problem when it becomes a pattern.
Right. I agree with that.
So you don't want to be somebody that you've worked with. Maybe the client has come in 5 times and then they had 2 weird instances where they were either late or canceled last minute, but they had a reason for it. You need to evaluate, is this now becoming a pattern, or was this person unlucky to have had 2 very unfortunate instances happen in their life that warranted this? Because if you hold the line too strong, they're going to think you're unreasonable and they'll just go find somebody else.
Right.
Whereas I had a woman comment on one of my Instagram posts just last week, I think. And she said that she has been training a woman for a long time. The woman consistently shows up 20 minutes late. And then the woman knows that she doesn't have a client coming after, so she expects her to train her still for the full hour. And she's afraid to say something because she's afraid that the client's going to quit or the client will go find a new trainer. And my advice to her was to say, what's been going on so far is you've been coming at least 20 minutes late to your session. I need you to come on time. Can you come on time, or should we start your session at the 30 minute mark instead of at the top of the hour? So now you've given the client an option. You've first of all told them, I'm observing a behavior that I'm not okay with. So to remedy that, I'm giving you 2 options to choose mm-hmm. from so that you can take some accountability in telling me what's going to work. Then let's say she says, no, I'll show up on time. If she comes again the next time and she's 20 minutes late again, all you need to say is, okay, we've got 40 minutes today. Let's get right to work. And you hold the boundary that you stop at the top of the hour. Mm-hmm. And that's hard because, of course, you risk people quitting. But when you think about that, are those really the people that you want as clients anyway? They don't respect your time. There might be an instance in your life where you don't have any clients. And so, yes, you need them. Well, then you need to have some confidence to communicate and set some boundaries. But most of us aren't that desperate for clients. And if they treat us like that and they continue to do that, even after you set clear expectations, then that person is not the best client.
I really like
that you probably want to fire.
Exactly. I really like in step three that you gave them two options, because when someone says, Tom, what time do you want to work out tomorrow? And you give 24 hours. It's like, Tom, do you want to work out at 5 or at 6? I have two options. Maybe I don't like either, but I get to pick one. And when you're working with a colleague or a client or patient, whatever, I think sometimes we need to limit options and make it more clear for them what you expect, instead of saying, what can we do to be better? Or what are your thoughts on, or, you know, what time works better? I think those two options narrow the options in that instance. And I think that just helps with clarity.
Oh, absolutely. And people, you want to create as little work as possible for your paying clients.
Right.
And if they don't, you don't want to give them a 12-hour window, like you said, just let them pick. And if it doesn't work, what they'll likely respond with is a specific time that does work for them. And then you've now you've reduced it to two simple communications versus going back and forth.
Absolutely. Another thing I just want to mention is, it's one of my favorite studies. They looked at physical therapy outcomes and they had 15, 20 variables. And the top two in successful PT outcomes for patients were, did they like their therapist and how close they lived to the clinic? So what is, minimize the excuses of not getting a PT, and did they have like a positive interaction with the person they're working with? And if you think about those two, have nothing to do with the exercises chosen, the modalities chosen, like the timing, none of that stuff that we think is really important. It's, can we get along? So you're more likely to do the things, you're more likely to come on time. And I'm sure if they did that in personal training, it'd be the same thing, where do you like the person you're working with? And can you minimize the excuses of not getting there, so you can see those long-term results?
Absolutely. I'm training a woman right now who, she lives about 20 minutes from where our home is, and that's where our gym is in our home. Mm-hmm. And she works a night shift, and she's tired all of the time. And she was canceling a lot of workouts. She was giving me advance notice, but she was canceling a lot. And what we did is, I said, let's sit down, let's look at your work schedule. And she passes by my house to and from work. So we found a way that she either stops here for her workout on her way to work, or she stops on her way back.
Sure.
Because then now it's not even a thing. It just is built into, it's like what James Clear talks about in Atomic Habits, habit stacking. Find a way to make it simple. And that's what we did. Now she doesn't have to make a separate trip. She just comes here either before or after.
Also the guilt of driving by the place you work out and not stopping.
That's so true.
I think that's a big part of it too. Whenever I drive by, the gym that I work out at, and it's a day I haven't worked out, it's like, oh, I should probably go. And I think maybe a little bit of guilt in there, but yeah, making it simple. And I think as coaches, sometimes we want it simple for us. What's the best schedule for me? What's the best opportunity for me? What's the best client for me? But make it simple for the clients, and then they'll make it simple for, it'll come back around at some point. But if you're the most difficult coach in the world, it's gonna be a hard time to get people to like you and want to be with you and want to train with you.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
A lot of the strategies you're talking about, they do make common sense, but they aren't always articulated to us in a way where we would need to learn this. Are there classes in middle school, high school, college that this stuff should be reiterated in it, or is it already presented and we just don't pay attention to it growing up throughout our schooling?
I wasn't exposed to any communication skills education through my academics in middle school, high school, and then in college, the only exposure I had was through trial by fire. It's, you have a presentation to give, stand up in front of the room, but I was never taught how to do anything. And then you go into the business world and you realize that now it's thousands of people who are coming who have no education. And so everybody kind of just picks and chooses what they think works best. I have now, since I've been coaching communication skills, have coached thousands of corporate professionals, and it's from graduate students all the way up to CEOs. And it is amazing because I work with some executives and I think it's amazing that you've been able to get this far with the communication skills like you have. And that's simply because there's no bar established. Nobody ever gets fired for giving a bad presentation. But what's the hard sell for me is, and this would go for anybody in fitness too, is when you don't communicate well, you miss out on a lot of opportunities that you will never know about.
Right.
I don't know what those are. So I can't sell that to people, but all I can say is I've been on the other side now since doing this and my clients working with me or working in some capacity on these skills. They've now realized all of these other avenues of opportunity that weren't present before. So no, I don't think it's taught. And you also asked about how to do it. The reason why I'm so interested in pursuing this type of education with fitness and sport and health professionals is because they understand and value what practice is. Communication at the heart is a behavioral skill set. And it's a skill set that you cannot get better at without practicing and applying in a deliberate way. Mm-hmm. So my role and the mission that I take on when I work with clients is to teach them the tactical skills of communication so that when they go to practice, they know this is exactly what I want to do with my hands. This is how I want to manage my voice. This is the sentence structure that I want to use when I communicate, or this is the framework that I want to organize my information for a presentation in, because that's not what's taught. And I follow a lot of other people who are teaching communication skills, both in the fitness space and then also mostly in the corporate space. And they make it so complicated. And I don't know if that's because making it simple feels like, oh, if I make it too simple, then people will think there's no value in what I'm doing. But that's not the case, because everybody is just concerned about their own little work, right? If you're a PT, all you're concerned about is being a PT. You're not going to spend your extra time reading communication books and practicing. It's much easier to just hire a coach who can actively help you practice the skills, apply them, work through them in scenarios, and then you can disengage with the coach. And now you've got a set of skills that you can take moving forward.
I agree. If you can make, 4 months of work for me into, 1 week, that's why I'm hiring you, to make my life easier and to save me time, because that is one resource I don't have enough of. I'm glad you brought up presentations. That's one of the main things I want to talk to you about today.
Okay.
I would rather get hit by a bus then give a presentation to a group of 10 people, much less 100 or 1,000. And I think a lot of people feel that way. And logically in their brain, it does not make sense, because every time they do it, it goes well, they get great feedback and they're glad they had the opportunity. But the lead up to it, the anticipation, like the worrying, the ruminating thoughts, it's almost a traumatic event. And I just want to know, what things have you, and if anyone wants to know more about you, follow your Twitter, follow your blog, get your emails. There's so much helpful information there. But just to kind of sum it up, can you give a handful of things that you have given people to help you overcome that angst, that anxiety, that fear, whatever you want to call it, about public speaking?
Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing to say is that you can never get rid of the nervous energy. That is a biological feature that we all have. Our brains evolved to tell us that when we are standing alone in front of a group of people without a weapon, that is really dangerous. So right away, when you stand up in front of a group of people and you're completely exposed to them, everything in you is saying, this is a super, super dangerous place to be, so don't be there. Now, those nerves, I find it interesting to also, when I tell people that nervous energy, that's the same exact energy you get when you're excited about something. You're just perceiving it as being a negative energy versus mm-hmm. a positive one. The best way to take advantage of that is to know what to do with the energy. And that's why getting a communication skills coach or learning tactical communication skills is important, because now all of a sudden, when you stand up to give a presentation and you feel nervous, instead of the nerves coming out through your feet where you're just kind of dancing around the stage the whole time, moving needlessly, now you can say, I'm going to keep my feet still. And instead, I'm going to direct that energy to project my volume to be more powerful. And I'm going to use it to gesture bigger so that I can establish a confident and big presence in front of the room. Or I'm going to use that energy to focus on speaking to one person at a time so that I can engage individuals in my group. Most of us, the nerves overwhelm us because we don't know what to do with it. And it ends up coming out in ways that are unhelpful and, and get in the way of us being able to communicate and resonate with the people that we're speaking to.
That makes a lot of sense. All I heard was I need a weapon in my hand and I'll feel better. So I might have to try.
True. Now, the best advice I can give somebody to overcoming nerves is making eye contact. I talk about eye contact a lot, and I do it because regardless of how much I talk about it, every single person I work with really struggles to do it. Think about when you're having a one-on-one conversation with somebody, you're looking at them, right? We spend the majority of our time in one-on-one conversations looking at people in the eyes, both when we are speaking to them as well as when we're listening to them. When we're in one-on-one conversations, almost always we feel extremely confident in ourselves and we feel competent.
Sure.
We want to create that same feeling in a group setting. So why not take what we're doing in a one-on-one setting and just use it in a group? When you stand in front of the group, all you're going to tell yourself is, I'm going to have multiple one-on-one conversations as I speak to this group. I'm going to look at Tom and I'm going to have a quick conversation with Tom. I'm then going to stop. I'm going to look at Sarah and I'm going to have a quick conversation with Sarah and then I'm going to stop. We're really good at having one-on-one conversations. We are more, our voice is more natural when we're focused on one person. We need to mimic that in a group setting. It's like I heard someone use an analogy about swimming that I really like.
I love analogies, so let's hear it.
Oh, good. Okay. So when you teach a kid how to swim and you teach them in a pool that's 4 feet deep and they learn how to swim, they feel good. Why is it that when you then take a kid to a diving well, that's what, 12 or 15 feet deep, they freak out? They know how to swim. Why is it that just because there's more water, it made it any different? The skills are the same. The environment is the same.
That's a perfect analogy. And I like the eye contact in terms of make it a setting that you're comfortable in. Like, let's try to mimic that. And if that's just looking at maybe you have three or four people in the crowd you keep looking at, I think that's beautiful. I think that makes so much sense to me as a presenter and as a person.
Yeah. So the hurdles that people need to overcome when you start using that skill is your instincts or your intellect might say, if I only look at one person, everybody else in my audience is going to feel disengaged. And that's not true. So if you think about yourself in an audience setting and you see the presenter or the speaker, whatever situation it is, making direct eye contact with someone, you feel extremely engaged because you know that at some point they might look directly at you. And we as human beings like to get credit for things. So we then will likely give that speaker our attention for a longer period of time, hoping that they come and look at us so that we get credit for making eye contact with them. It just conveys a level of confidence that you don't get when you see someone kind of scanning all over the place. When people make eye contact, it shows that they're focused on what they're saying. They're confident enough in themselves to make eye contact with people from a body language standpoint, there's a lot of benefits.
I think that makes a complete amount of sense. And I think it gives you a sense of control over the situation and not this presentation's happened to me. I am doing my best during this time. And and you can focus on those things and not those ruminating thoughts of what's going to go wrong, or I'm going to look like, like I don't know what I'm talking about, or I'm going to forget my, you know, my lines or anything like that. When someone starts to work with you as a coach, what can they expect in terms of development and in terms of, you know, frequency and things like that? How does that work with the clients that you work with on the communication piece?
There's a few different ways. I found that the best outcomes I've had are when people come to me and they're actively working on a project. They either are faced with a scenario, a professional scenario at work, and they're not sure how to handle it from a communication standpoint. So then we work through the scenario together, or they've signed themselves up or have been asked to give a speech or a presentation, and we work together on that. And then there are other clients that come and they just say, I want to get better at communication. And then all I do is teach them the skills, and I have practice exercises that they can use. I ask them to bring content that they can talk from that they're comfortable with. But I've found that if my clients come and they're actively working on something, it has them be more focused. They feel they're able to apply it in a more meaningful way.
Right.
And if they can apply it in a meaningful way, they pick up on the skills much quicker. But right now I'm just working on more of a one-on-one consulting basis. What I do for Fit to Speak started off as more of a passion project. I love communication. I spend every single extra moment of my time learning about, reading about, talking about communication. And I cannot believe that that's coming out of my mouth, because I never thought that that would be my where my career ended up. But where was I going with that? I completely just lost my train of thought.
That's okay. Just to add on top of that, I think when you are coaching, you get a lot of subjective feedback, like, oh, the presentation went well, or this project went well, or, you know, I'm in training, like, I feel like I'm getting stronger, I feel better. Do you have any objective measurements that you can look at to know that your coaching's helping, or that the client is implementing or using your tactics well?
Yeah, well, it depends on what we're evaluating. So let's use the example of your speaking skills. When somebody, if I was watching, let's say you sent me a recording of you giving a presentation at a seminar, you were standing up delivering from slides to an audience. What I would evaluate you on is your presence skills. And your presence is made up of what you do physically as you speak, and then what you do vocally as you speak. I would provide objective observations about how you managed your eye contact, how you managed your hands, both when you were gesturing and then what you did with them when you weren't gesturing. I would talk to you about your posture and your movement in regards to how you used it when delivering content or information, and then how you used it if you were interacting with people in your audience. On the vocal side, we would talk about your volume. We would talk about your tone and inflection, the pace at which you were speaking, and then your use of filler words. So that's how I would objectively evaluate somebody on from a speaking standpoint. And then the other side of that is what I would call message organization. How well did your message flow? Was it relevant to the specific audience you were speaking to? In what order did you structure the content of your message? Did that order make sense? Did you include the information that was only necessary to know instead of doing a data dump of everything you knew about a topic? Did you have a point to make? Did you make a request at the end of your message for a specific action to be taken or next steps of some sort? Yeah, the more objective, the better. And that's why.
Right. That's why I would think, but yeah.
People who, when you give a presentation, you need to be careful about who you solicit feedback from. And if you do solicit feedback, you need to ask pointed questions about what kind of feedback you want. Now, if you came to me and I was just I had no idea about communication skills, but I was in your presentation and you said, hey, Jenny, what'd you think? Oh, it was great, Tom. You did really well. Or what if I said, it was good, but you seemed a little bit nervous. What could you do with that information? Do you know, would you know how to be not nervous? Because if you did, wouldn't you have done something in the first place?
Right. I think I'd be more nervous the next time because now I'm thinking about, oh, I look nervous. I got to do something different. Like it's almost right. detrimental to have
right.
that thing if I don't have the strategies to improve.
Right. Right. It's like, but even on the other side of that, if someone said, Jenny, you did great. You sounded super confident. I would say that's wonderful. But what did I do that made me sound confident? Because I now want to replicate that, but I don't know how to replicate it.
Right.
And that's when where, you yeah. solicit feedback, you need to ask pointed questions. Did my movement distract you from listening to what I was saying? Did you feel like, what pace did you think I spoke at? Was I fast? Was I speaking slow? How were you able to hear me clearly? What were there any slides in my presentation that you didn't understand what the point was? That's how you solicit helpful feedback. Otherwise, people don't want to hurt your feelings. They'll just say either, yeah, you did great. I think you were a little bit nervous, but overall you did great. That's complete. That doesn't help me one bit. It makes my ego feel good for a moment, but from I can't repeat it then because I don't know what I did.
And that's what I get with the podcast. People say, hey, the podcast is great. Sounds great. You're doing a great job. And I'm always like, thanks. I don't know how that helps me. I don't know what to do with that information. And, but if I only get the, hey, you sound terrible on that, or your voice sound terrible, or you sound really nervous, I get really defensive. And then I also don't know what to do with that information because I don't always have the strategy to fix that the criticism or insult. And but usually right. it's more of the positive. People are like, hey, it's great. I'm always like, thanks, really appreciate it. Right. But I'd like to share
something you do really well. Can I share something you do really well?
Yes. No one can see me blush, so we're okay.
When you ask questions, you allow your guest to elaborate for as long as they want, essentially. And people always naturally come to an end in what they're saying. And as soon as they're done, because you were listening with such intensity, you've pulled out a small little detail in what they said that becomes an entirely new conversation. That is the epitome of good listening. Conversations only come to dead ends when we can't identify all of the branches that people give us to tug on for new conversations to start. So there's some feedback for you. Great job being an active listener and identifying certain pieces of what somebody is saying and tying it back to what the purpose of your podcast is to educate and relate to coaches and PTs and others in the field.
I really appreciate that because that is something I have made a conscious effort of doing, especially in the last 6 months. I listen to a lot of podcasts and I've noticed that trend when there's a difference between having a solid script of every single question you want to ask and not deviating from the script, or having ideas, topics, thoughts, but asking the question. And the most fault, especially with coaches love to talk about their program, their system, their philosophies, their stories. If you give them time to tell the story, they're going to do a better job than interjecting every 30 seconds. Well, what about this? Well, what about that? That doesn't help. So I've learned from that. And I've also learned that the guest is more engaged when you ask them a question about what they just told you. So it makes for a better podcast on both ends, both, I guess on all three ends, for the host, for the guest, and for the listener. So I really appreciate that feedback because that is something I've really tried on this podcast to be better at. And I think a lot of your clients and people that you work with have seen that progress as well. And I'm just going to wrap up the podcast here because
cool.
Now that we're talking about how well we're doing this stuff, I can't think of the next subject. Thank you so much.
People need to know how to give praise, right?
Well, that was good. Specific praise. It wasn't, Tom, you're doing a great job. It was something very poignant and
right.
very direct. And I appreciate it because it is something I'm working on. So
good.
Thank you so much, Jenny. All your stuff will be in the show notes. And I'm really excited to learn more from you. And I hope all the listeners give you a follow and they learn from you as much as I have.
Thank you, Tom. It was an absolute pleasure. I really enjoyed being here.